17 seconds in counting. Guidance internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2.
Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are willing to postpone, and one we intend to win.
Okay, engine stop. ATA at a descent. Flight control mode, auto descent, engine command override off. Engine arm on. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This is Cosmic Perspective. I'm your host, Andy Pineros. Today on Cosmic Perspective, my guest is a longtime adventure journalist, author of The Right Stuff, interviews with icons of the 1960s. He has skied the South Pole, visited the North Pole twice, driven a Bugatti Veyron at a top speed of 253 miles per hour, flown in a Russian MiG to the edge of space, and has ticket number 610 on Virgin Galactic's Spaceships 2 suborbital flight into space. Jim Clash, welcome, and thanks for being on Cosmic Perspective.
Well, Andy, listening to that build-up, I sound like I'm a nut, a little crazy, but yeah, it's great to be on Cosmic Perspectives, and it's great to be with you today.
You've had so many accomplishments in your career as a journalist. This list is incredible, and I only have a small part of it here. At what age did you realize that you had this adventurous spirit?
Well, it's funny, you know, hindsight is always 20/20. But when I look back now, I think it goes back to my ham radio days. Back when I was a kid, I got my ham radio license, and I used to speak with people around the world. During the Cold War with the Soviet Union, I was talking to probably high-level communist officials. I was 13 years old, and I think that's a lot. That had a lot to do with my quest for travel, certainly to exotic parts of the world. And also, I was into sports. I ran track. I was a sprinter. So I had that component. And eventually, that led me to mountaineering. And you know, mountaineering spread into race car driving. And, of course, the ultimate for me as a baby boomer was to someday go into space. And, of course, now we've got ways to do that for civilians, or we will soon. And I guess if I had to look back, I would say it was a combination of ham radio, sports, and of course science. I was very interested in science, physics. I built a laser when I was in ninth grade for the science fair, and I think the judges gave me first place because they didn't know what they'd never seen anything like that. But that was back in, you know, 68, so that's a long time ago.
And you actually went to the South Pole and used a ham radio from the South Pole one time, is that correct?
That's right. That's a good story because when I was I guess I was 15 or 16, and I talked to the South Pole station on the ham radio, the Amundsen Scott station, which is right there on the South Pole, and it was so exciting for me. You know, I tried for many, many years to talk to that station. It was always crowded. A lot of people were trying to contact the South Pole when he came on the air. So when I actually skied to the South Pole in 2005, I got on the ham radio down there, and kind of lived the dream out in reverse. I got on and talked to some other people from around the world and gave them a shot at talking to the South Pole. So that was pretty cool.
That must have been quite an experience.
Yeah, it really was.
You mentioned that as a kid, the ultimate for you as a baby boomer would be to go into space. And you have flown to the edge of space. What's it like to fly to the edge of space in a Russian MiG?
Yeah, back a while ago, I was doing a big story for Forbes on space tourism, and I found out in my research that the only, or the highest you could go at that point was in a MiG-25 Foxbat, and you had to go to Russia to do it. And so I went over, and I did my training, which is nothing more than a morning with some Russian technicians where they put you into a pressure suit and teach you about ejection and the oxygen mask and all that. And next thing you know, in the afternoon, I was being led out to a bucket of bolts, really, this MiG-25 Foxbat, which is considered Russia's greatest plane. It will fly, I believe, above Mach, I think it goes up to Mach 3.2, and it has flown to 123,000 feet. So it really is a marvelous machine, but you have to understand, when I went, it was old, and it was kind of scary. So,
I bet it was. That.
Yeah, and I remember I had to sign a million different forms, and the last one, I was in the plane, and someone came up, and they made me sign something in Russian. I have no idea what that was. Maybe someday they'll, you know, come after me and for my firstborn or something. But I signed it because I went all the way over there to do this flight. But it's pretty unique, you know. You take off, and then you you know, probably normal speed. You go up to 30,000 feet, and then the pilot really starts to accelerate. And as you go through the sound barrier, you feel a little shudder on the plane. You see the needle flash Mach 1. And then we just kept going and accelerating through Mach 2. And then we started to climb. And, boy, it was an amazing sensation. The higher we got, the darker the sky got. And as we got up to, well, we topped out at about almost 84,000 feet, you really saw the blackness of space, the curvature of the Earth, and the atmosphere hanging over the Earth, and it's very, very thin compared to what you think it might be. And so, you know, that for me was sort of the final nail in me wanting to go to space, just seeing that view. I was a quarter of the way to space at that altitude. It's about 16 miles, and made me want to go and purchase a ticket and go the rest of the way. And certainly as a baby boomer, growing up and watching Neil and Buzz land on the moon and John Glenn orbit the Earth and pull us even with the Soviets in the space race, you know, we all thought we'd get to go earlier than we have. And I think a lot of us are disappointed. I know a lot of the astronauts are disappointed that we stopped going to the moon in 1972 with Gene Cernan's flight, Apollo 17. So there's a big pent-up demand for a lot of people, and one of them is me.
Yes, I have to agree with you on that one. Being a baby boomer myself, I thought by this time I would have had the opportunity to go into space.
And you'll get to do it.
I hope so.
What's going to happen is the prices are going to come down once they get flying regularly. And I think if you have kids, your kids are really going to get to fly for a decent price. It's kind of like the airline industry. When it started, it was only for the super rich, and then as more and more people flew and became more reliable, there were less accidents. You know, you have now mass tourism with everybody flying.
This is Cosmic Perspective. I'm your host, Andy Panaros. Today my guest is adventure journalist Jim Clash. We've been discussing his adventurous spirit as a youth, his flight on a Russian MiG, and his desire to go into space. We're going to take a break. When we return, we're going to discuss what it feels like to go to the edge of space in a Russian MiG, and Jim's experience when flying at supersonic speed in the English Electric Lightning. We're going to continue our discussion with Jim's supersonic flying experiences. Jim, can you tell us about the actual physical experience of flying to the edge of space in a Russian MiG? You reached the speed of Mach 2.6, I believe.
Yeah, we reached Mach 2.6 and topped out at about 84,000 feet.
Did you ever feel any dizziness or lightheadedness or anything like that?
Well, the one thing I can say, Andy, about the MiG flight, it was not designed for aerobatic or anything like that. It was just a straight flight. We did the whole thing in 35 minutes. We were up and down in 35 minutes. We burned 5,000 gallons of jet fuel, which is an enormous amount of fuel for a 35-minute ride. But we didn't, you know, we didn't focus on flips and things like that. It was a straight shot. But I did feel the G-forces when we were starting to turn. We turned left when we were up pretty high to climb. And it was a very, very, very wide arc. But because we were going so fast, the G-forces were still pretty intense. And I had a camera in my right hand, a small camera, and suddenly it weighed like it felt like it weighed, I don't know, 20 pounds. And it was an illusion because I'm looking at my hand and I've got this little camera, but it really felt like it weighed 20 pounds. And that was because of the G-forces, because we were turning left. So that flight, I didn't pull too many G's, but it is a little disorienting. And, you know, as you go up, you've got this oxygen mask on, you're in a confined cockpit. I was on the nose of the plane in a separate cockpit. My pilot was probably 10 feet behind me in another cockpit, and we only could communicate via radio. And he didn't speak very good English, very little English, in fact. When we got ready to take off, he came over to me, and he was making sure I had the seat belts on right and all that. You're belted in with all this stuff. And he's going over ejection procedure with me, and he says, "Now, Jim, if I give command eject, 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 this is not command for discussion, only for fulfillment." And I'm going, "Oh, okay, great. You know, we're going to be 80,000 feet up," and I suddenly get the command, and I have to pull these two handles. And then he looks over at this red thing, lower right in the cockpit, and he says, "But do not touch this." And I said, "Why not?" He goes, "You could eject me." And I'm thinking, oh, boy, this is Russia. This would not be even in an American plane for a tourist. But I understand why it's there. It's in case somebody gets into trouble and, say, the pilot passes out and you're in a trainer plane, you have to eject the pilot. But the whole time I'm flying, I'm thinking, boy, I better not drop my camera and hit that handle. What if I eject him? Then I'm flying this plane at 80,000 feet. I'm going to have to eject, too.
I don't think anybody realizes the risk that you go through when you do a flight like that. Now, you've also taken other flights, broken the sound barrier before on other flights.
Yeah, I've actually been through the sound barrier on three different flights, the MiG-25 Foxbat, which was the first time. Then I flew the Concorde on the last flight. A bunch of journalists were taken over to Bermuda and back. We didn't land, but we did that in a little over an hour. And I hit Mach 2, and we went up to 60,000 feet. And, you know, at 60,000 feet, there's a very dark sky. But, boy, when you're at 84,000 feet, there's a big difference. It's black. And then the third one I did was on the old English Electric Lightning, which is the British kind of the equivalent to the Russian MiGs. It I think it tops out at Mach 2.2 and flies up to about 70,000 feet. That flight was a real eye-opening flight for me in a lot of ways. We didn't really go that fast. We went Mach 1.1, and the pilot Dave Stock let me take the stick and let me take it through the sound barrier, which was kind of cool. In the English Electric Lightning, you're seated next to each other under one cockpit. We still had oxygen masks on, pressure suits, and we could only communicate via radio, but it was more reassuring in some way having the pilot next to me. And, of course, I had my own set of controls and everything. So he let me take it through the sound barrier. And we flew at a maximum height a little above 40,000 feet. So it wasn't in any way exciting in that perspective because I'd been twice as high. But what happened is very interesting. We were out there. Thunder City is where they do these flights for tourists, or they used to anyway, and it's near Cape Town. There was an air show out there, and the annual air show at Bredasport on the coast down there in South Africa, and Dave and I had to fly the plane from Thunder City over to the coast where the air show was happening. So it was a flight of about, 25 minutes. And again, nothing dramatic. However, when we came in to land at the air show airstrip, we didn't land. We just stayed about 20 feet above the runway, and I kept thinking, when's he going to put it down? And suddenly we're at the end of the runway, and he just pulls the thing straight up. And you have to understand, the English Electric Lightning is very, very well known for its vertical climb. It's set several records for that. And in fact, Dave had taken Richard Branson on some of those record-setting runs earlier. Anyway, we go straight up, and then suddenly we do 7 minutes of the most disquieting aerobatics I've ever experienced. Flips and rolls and high speed, anything you can imagine. And there's a saying about airplanes, about God. And there are three sayings. One is, oh my God, I'm going to die. The second is, oh my God, let me die because I feel so horrible. And you really do. And the third one, when you're finished, is, oh my God, I'm glad that's over. And I went through all of those in 7 minutes. I was vomiting so intensely. My oxygen mask was pulled to the side, and I was being thrown around in that cockpit like a rag doll. When we finally landed, I was upset. I wanted an explanation, and he told me, well, he didn't know at the time, but he had to perform all the maneuvers he was going to do the next day in the air show, that day before the air show, so that they could see that the plane was flight worthy and that he was competent to do the, it was just technical bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was angry, and we got out of the plane, and he said, you don't realize it now, but you're going to see this in a few days as a life-changing experience. And I thought, yeah, right. And he asked if I was going to stick around for the air show, and I couldn't. I was had to go down back to Cape Town and do a rappel off Table Mountain. They have the longest single rappel in the world there. It's about 350 feet off the Table Mountain. And so anyway, I went back, and the next day I read the paper that evening, and there had been a mishap at the air show. And so I'm reading, because, this is interesting to me suddenly, because I know about the air show, and I keep reading, and then I see it's the Electric Lightning. And then I see it's Dave Stock, and then I think, oh, my God, it's the same plane I was in yesterday. And sure enough, it was. The plane developed hydraulic problems. Dave tried to ditch the fuel and get it away from the crowd and eject, and the ejection seat didn't work, and he was killed, and the plane was, destroyed. So for me, it was one of those wake-up moments. It was like someone punched me in the stomach. I was the last person in that plane before it crashed, and also we had pushed that plane to the absolute limit, and who knows what we did to it that day. It's an old plane built in the 60s, late 50s. I'd been, flying for a long time, so made me think about adventure and risk and all that.
With all this risk that you take, Do you ever feel fear during this time when you're taking these risks?
Well, it's interesting. I do feel fear. I climb mountains. I'm afraid of heights, but not so much anymore since I've been climbing. I've climbed the Matterhorn. So I've done a lot of self-purging of fear. I drive race cars. One of the things about fear is that it's apprehension before you get in to whatever you're going to get into. But once you're doing it, you got to concentrate on what you're doing. And that's a good thing, because it makes you not think about it. But there is a difference between flying in an airplane like I was and driving a car or climbing a mountain where you're actually in control. So in the MiG, in the Electric Lightning, I was a passenger. So there is some fear, And I have to say, the fear is different in different situations. I was afraid of throwing up in the English Electric Lightning. And I was a little afraid for my life giving those aerobatics we were doing, which were really insane. I have a video from inside the cockpit that I got actually after I got back to the United States and after the plane had crashed. They had taken the video out before the next day. But I look at that video, you know, once, and I can't look at it again. It makes me sick just looking at it. And, of course, there are emotions associated with it. But I think the fear thing is, the other thing for me as a journalist is sometimes I become the third person. I'm not really experiencing it. I'm the omniscient Nick Carraway third-person observer because I have to go out and I have to do it for a story. And so I have this permission, almost like an actor, to do it, and I have pressure on me, and I'm thinking about writing the story, and I'm thinking about what's happening. So that's a good distraction as well from fear. But fear is healthy, and I think that if you don't have it, you're in trouble. And there is a lot of the astronauts I've spoken with and interviewed and yeah, just adventurers and explorers, the reason they're successful is that they are calculated risk takers. They do have fear, but they know how to mitigate the risks. You know, I remember when I first met Steve Fawcett and interviewed him, I thought, you know, this guy has done so many firsts. And when I first met him, I thought he doesn't even look like he's in that good of shape. He doesn't look like an athlete. But as I got to talk with him, I realized he is the ultimate risk-averse guy. He plans everything out so that, you know, the likelihood of something happening is almost nil. But then again, there is that chance that something can go wrong, and that's what makes it adventure or exploration.
This is Cosmic Perspective. Today we've been talking with my guest, Jim Clash. Jim is a longtime adventure journalist. We've been discussing what it's like to travel at supersonic speeds, risk-taking, and the role that fear plays when taking risks. We're going to take a quick break. After the break, we'll discuss advice that Jim's received from astronauts about going into space and what will take place during his suborbital flight on Virgin Galactic's Spaceship Two. We're going to continue this very cool discussion with adventure journalist and risk-taker Jim Clash. Jim, you've interviewed several astronauts over the years, and they've given you their firsthand experiences of going into space. Have you ever received any advice from astronauts for your future suborbital flight on Spaceship Two?
You know, over the years, it's interesting. When I first started talking about getting a ticket to go into space, the astronauts were more cautious, and many of them would say, I don't think that's going to happen, and if it does, it's going to be very dangerous. I've noticed recently in the last couple of years that many of the same astronauts I had interviewed are now getting onto the bandwagon and saying, you know what, this is going to happen. It's a question of when, and so it's changed. And I like that, being a ticket holder. Now, remember, we're talking about suborbital flight, and all these guys have done orbital, and certainly many of them have been to the moon, so it's a very different thing. But for me, having never been to space, it's a big deal, and I look at it as kind of the poor man's way to space by going suborbital.
You're passenger number 610 on Virgin Galactic Spaceship Two. Would you explain to our listeners what will take place from takeoff to landing on your suborbital flight?
Well, okay, first of all, you're right. I am passenger 610. I bought a ticket 3 years ago. There are different ways to buy a ticket. I put down 10%, which was $20,000 back then when the tickets were $200,000. Branson's raised the price now to $250,000, but I'm locked in at the $200,000 price. The first 500 people to fly will have paid for their tickets up front 100%. So those of us who put down deposits, and then in the order that you put down your deposit, that determines when you fly. So that's why I'm 610. But anyway, the logistics of it are such that there will be six tourists, six passengers with two pilots in Spaceship Two, and we will take off on the underbelly of White Knight Two. So if you can imagine, the spaceship is attached to an airplane, and that airplane takes off like an airplane, and then we'll fly up to about 50,000 feet, certainly nowhere near space. And when all is copacetic, we will be dropped from the mothership, and we will fall for several hundred yards until the pilot in our craft lights the rocket engine. And when that happens, we're going to go up very rapidly and with a lot of G-force on our bodies up to about 370 or 80,000 feet, which is space. Space is considered 100 kilometers above the Earth, or 62 miles. And that's going to be a violent part of the trip. And you're riding it for maybe a minute and a half, so you get up there pretty fast. And once you're up, then you'll start to arc over, kind of like Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom did when they did their suborbital flights before John Glenn went orbital back in the 60s. And in that time period, you'll become weightless. You'll unstrap from your seats and float around. And certainly you're going to be looking out the windows, because that's what you're there for, the view and the weightlessness. And, you know, if it's anything like what I saw in the MiG, and it's going to be four times as high as the MiG, it's going to be a life-changing experience.
And how long would this flight take, the total time, and how long would you be weightless for?
Well,
approximately.
I understand, and again, this is all still speculation, but the whole thing from start takeoff to finish reentry and landing will be a couple of hours maximum. Now, the time you're actually in space is probably between 5 and 10 minutes and weightless and all that. So, you know, you're paying a lot of money if you amortize $200,000 over, you know, say it's 6 minutes in space. That's you know, $30,000 or more a minute. And so you want to make sure that you're familiar with those sort of sensations before you go. And that's another thing I'm really intent on, is doing as much of this kind of activity before I go up, space-like activity, so that when I'm up there, I'll be able to enjoy it and I'll be not disoriented and all that kind of stuff.
You've also flown a parabolic flight.
Yeah, exactly. There is a way to simulate weightlessness. The United States used to do it with its astronauts in the old KC-135s, which are they call it the vomit comet for a good reason.
Yes.
The Russians did it in the old Ilyushin 76s, the cosmonauts. And so I did go over to Russia, and I trained in an Ilyushin 76. What you do in parabolic flight is you go up to about 35,000 feet, and then the plane arcs over like we'll do in Spaceship Two, and then it goes into a controlled dive for about 10,000 feet. And in that controlled dive, you are weightless for about 30 seconds. The plane then pulls up at about 25,000 feet, climbs again, and then goes into another controlled dive. And this happens 10 times. It's what we call parabolic flight. So you experience 10 bouts of 30 seconds worth of weightlessness. And it's very interesting the first couple of times you come up off the floor, and the little things you learn about what to do and what not to do when you're weightless. I learned immediately that you never really push off of anything too hard, because there's nothing to control your trajectory once you leave whatever you touched. And the sort of the force that you push off with is how fast you're going to go through the air, and also where you're going to go. You can't correct. I remember once I had a little bag with me, and it fell, it got away from me. It was floating away, and my first instinct was to breaststroke toward it, because the sensation is a lot like being in water, but of course I didn't go anywhere. Another thing I remember, and I learned this pretty quickly, you don't want to be anywhere near the ceiling of the plane when it's about to go into its climbing phase. In other words, when you're not weightless anymore, because I was up pretty high near the ceiling, maybe 12 feet, and suddenly I fell to the floor like a rock because we were going into our climb phase and we weren't weightless anymore. So it's interesting. Now, it does prepare you also for the nausea. It is very nausea-inducing, and I think that's important for people who are going to fly in Spaceship Two, because you're going to have, you're going to be affected by the forces, and you could get sick. And so I think, you know, if you get this under your belt, you can take these flights in the United States in retrofitted Boeing 727s with a company called Zero-G, Zero Gravity Corp, and they fly three or four different cities around the country. And I think it's $5,000. It's not too expensive. Nothing like the MiG flight. When I did the MiG flight, it was, well, now those flights, they don't do the 25 Fox bet anymore, the one I did that went as high as I went. But even the 29s, which maybe go up to 70,000 feet, a little less than Mach 2, those are over almost $30,000 now. So I think for the weightlessness, it's a pretty good bang for your buck if you've got a ticket. And that's something you really want to experience before you get on Spaceship Two.
It sounds like physically demanding compared to even your sound barrier breaking flights.
Yeah, it is. It's more physically demanding, and I think it's the kind of thing where your muscle memory, you're often when you climb big mountains, and I've been up to 23,000 feet without oxygen, but I climbed many smaller mountains and worked my way up. You know, altitude is something your body doesn't react to well, and it takes a while for you to acclimatize. And for me, the more often I went to big high mountains, the more my body had remembered what it was like, and the faster I was able to adapt. I think the same thing will be true of weightlessness. And for me, at least having done that parabolic flight once, I understand what's involved. My body probably subconsciously will remember that. There'll be some muscle memory. And I think that's why, of course, the astronauts would train in those things. So I would recommend that to anybody who's going to fly on a suborbital flight.
This is Cosmic Perspective. My guest today is adventure journalist Jim Clash. We've been discussing what will happen during Jim's Virgin Galactic Spaceship Two flight into space. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to discuss Jim's most difficult and most exciting experiences. We're back with adventure journalist Jim Clash. What was your most exciting and most difficult of your past experiences?
Wow. Well, I would say for me, the most difficult thing I've ever done, and I think I'm the only journalist who's ever done this, when I was a kid, I was very into IndyCar racing, and I remember watching Tom Sneva break the 200-mile-an-hour barrier in 1977 at Indianapolis. It was kind of like a four-minute-mile Roger Bannister moment where no one ever thought someone could run a lap at over 200-mile-an-hour average at Indianapolis, and he did it qualifying for the 77 race. And I thought, boy, that's something. I just can't even imagine what it's like to be in a car the size of a go-kart moving at a football field a second through the corners. What kind of experience that would be. And I got it into my head that someday I wanted to do that. And it took me 25 years to do it, but through a number of training experiences at racing schools and my contacts in the Indy Racing League, I talked a guy, a car owner, Sam Schmidt, into letting me take his Indy car out and try to average a lap at 200 miles an hour, which means not just hit 200 on the straightaway, but average that, meaning go through the corners at that speed. And I went out to Texas Motor Speedway, a track I had driven on a lot. It's an oval. It's a tight oval. It's about a mile and a half around, and it's banked at 24 degrees in the corners. And I did 10 laps, and on the ninth lap, I hit average 201.2 miles an hour in an Indy car. And let me tell you something, that is a very physical experience, and it really tested my ability, because I was in the car by myself and I had to do it. So if you ask me what my most difficult adventure was, that was it. That's my sort of K2. In terms of the most exciting, boy, that's a good question. I guess I'd really, there are a lot of them. I mean, certainly topping out on the Matterhorn was exciting. Swimming at the North Pole was pretty cool. Skiing to the South Pole, a place I'd always wanted to go, was cool. But I guess in retrospect, that MiG flight, the MiG-25 Fox Bat, probably was the most exciting. And that was interesting in that the pictures I took at Apogee, our highest point, came out exactly the way I remember it up there. And most of you probably who've traveled and you see these beautiful sights, Grand Canyon, whatever, you take these photographs and you're all excited when you get home to look at them, and then you realize that when you see them, they're never quite as beautiful as it was when you were there. And for the MiG flight, it was just as beautiful in the photograph as what I remember. So I'd probably say the MiG was my most exciting. One thing I will tell you, though, the most violent thing I ever did, and I underestimated this tremendously, was I wanted to go down with a U.S. Olympic bobsled team from the top of the hill. And it took me 3 years to convince them to let me do it. I had to sign all kinds of forms. I had to go get a physical, EKG, all this stuff, and join the U.S. Bobsled Skeleton Federation. And one night I went up to Lake Placid. It was cold, and I went down the big hill up there from the top with Olympian John Napier. And I'm telling you, that was insane. It was less than a minute ride. We hit 80 miles an hour, and we went through, I think it was 20 different turns. Now, if you can imagine, some of them were more than 90 degrees. I was the pusher. I was the guy in the back. It was the two-man bobsled. So we just pushed the sled. I jumped in. And then I was the brake guy, and I didn't have to touch the brakes. I couldn't touch the brakes. Otherwise, I'd flip the sled until the end of the run. But we pulled 6 Gs in some of those corners, and I didn't know whether we were going to turn left or right. It was kind of like I was in this black box. So it was violent. It was the most violent thing I've ever done, and I was surprised. And to this day, when I see that on TV, I'm like, boy, you don't get a feel on television with the camera rolling what it's like to be inside of one of those things.
I never would have imagined that you would feel the effect of 6 Gs on your body during bobsledding.
Yeah, and very quickly. You don't even know, you don't get a chance to prepare for it because, as I say, I had my head down. I couldn't see anything. And we were, you know, taking left turns, right turns. Sometimes we'd be up vertical, parallel to the ground. Other times we wouldn't, depending upon what kind of a turn it was. And this guy was steering it, of course. He had to have reflexes like a Formula One driver. You 6 Gs and you don't know you're going to turn left or right, when it's going to happen. It's pretty intense.
Jim, thanks for being with us on Cosmic Perspective today. And thanks for sharing your very cool experiences with us. Good luck on your Spaceship 2 flight. I can tell you that I'm very jealous, and I hope I get a chance to go into space someday.
Andy, I think if you hang in there, you're young enough, you'll be able to go. As I say, if we don't have an accident, which is the fear of everybody in the space tourism industry, and these things start flying regularly, the prices are going to come down dramatically, and you got a shot, you know. Sometimes I think maybe I should sell my ticket and wait, but I'm just too excited to get up there.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
But thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed this.
Well, thank you very much for being on. Thanks again, and good luck, and have a good trip.
Okay, great. Thanks.